Okay, we've heard a lot about the deficit and the debt. Is there any correlation between these?
Some people, you gotta speak loud.
Some people believe that these things are just like a dog and pony show, and it's for the people, getting people busy, like to do a financial thing here, healthcare there, give opinion, call politicians and so on. Do you think there is a major inherent problem of the whole system which makes possible this kind of chickenery and plunder of the whole thing? And this is the system, some people think it's a system based on plunder and so on. And it's not a new thing, I'm saying. And it was the inevitable destiny, as they say, the religious people that prophesied, you know, again, this is prophesied. Go see the beginning of the century and last century, you go, they very, very well that this kind of system leads to this kind of thing. How do you expect regulation work with every force in the nation working against it, including the most influential?
One more, right here.
What's the relationship of other countries in regard to this problem? Since I heard at the time that they deregulated in 1996, European countries were objected to the deregulation of banks and commercial banks.
Let me take the questions in order, I guess, very briefly. Debt and deficit, what is the relationship? Well, are you talking about the government debt, the federal debt?
The federal debt. We've heard a lot about that. The federal debt, the deficit, federal, state, everything.
Yeah. Well, first of all, just as a technical matter, a deficit is, in any given year, how much more the government spends that it takes in taxes. And when it spends more than it takes in taxes, it has to borrow the difference. And as it borrows the difference, that adds to the debt. So there's a mathematical relationship between the debt and the deficit. The deficit is the amount each year that you have to borrow and that you add to the debt. Now the real question is, should we be worried? Does it matter? Do we really need to do something about this growing debt that we have? Everybody always likes to use these kind of homey household sorts of analogies, but they're not so bad if you do it correctly. It's really fairly simple, actually, when you think about it. Borrowing a lot of money is a bad idea if you're just going to throw it away. It can be a useful idea if you're going to invest it in something that you really need and can pay off in the future. And think about as a household, if your child's going to college and you can't afford to pay for it and you can't get enough financial aid, but the child is going to get education that will benefit him or her, then you may borrow the money and it may be worth it. On the other hand, if your child's going to take that money and go and buy a hot rod and drive it around and ram it into a tree, it's probably not a good use of borrowed money. Well, that's what the United States has been doing. It's been borrowing a lot of money and throwing it away on military adventures and so forth. And now we're in very serious trouble. But using the deficit to help pull us out of the recession, to give money to the states so that they can hire teachers and police officers and firefighters, to help companies make the transition to a green economy, this is a good use of the deficit and will pay us back returns in the future. So the general discussion of debt and deficit is very misleading. Moreover, remember that when the Republicans are in power, you never hear them worrying about the deficit. They're rolling up the deficit and then they tell the Democrats they have to clean up the mess. So we have to really put this in some kind of perspective, I think. Is this all really a dog and pony show, and is this real problem really related to the whole system? Yes, it is related to the problems in the whole system. Clearly, unfettered, an unregulated, and uncontrolled capitalist system can lead to plunder, avarice, instability, inequality, injustice, and inevitably we'll have these kinds of problems. The real question is, are there forms of regulation and social management of a capitalist system that can make it a fairly civilized system that can deliver benefits that are widely shared? And I think this is really the historic question for those of us living in capitalism, which is most of us in the world. Even in China, they're living in a form of capitalism now. And I think I can't answer that question for you. You know the cross arguments in the cases. You know the case of Sweden or Norway or Denmark or Europe between the wars, where there were very strong social controls and social safety net. And you know the United States after the Second World War, where we had what's called, political scientists call, an embedded capitalism, a capitalism that's embedded in government controls and community regulations and so forth. And for some people, those systems work pretty well. But there's no system that lasts forever, that's completely stable, because those who lose from that system, the formerly wealthy or the business people who have dreams of becoming more wealthy, they fight against that system. They mobilize politically. They try to break down the regulations. And unless there's a strong counterweight on the other side, popular resistance from labor and people and communities, they're going to win and turn it back to an avaricious form of capitalism. So was this inevitable? I don't know. This didn't happen to the same degree in Sweden or Norway or Denmark. It happened here. It happened in other parts of Europe. My personal feeling is that we need a kind of socialist mixed economy that has more social control over the economy, that has a strong counterweight, where there's rooms for small business people and small concentrations of profit making, but that there has to be a lot of community control and community economic and social activity. But that's my view, and I don't think we have any economic proof that one system is better than the other. There are a lot of historical examples we can look at. Other countries. Well, this is sort of a similar thing. If you look at what happened in other countries, there are other countries that had much better financial regulation and other kinds of regulations, and that did not have the same crisis. Look at Canada, for example. They had a much better regulated banking system than we did. If you look at China and India, they had much more strict controls over their financial system than we did, and they didn't have the same crisis. Countries that had very few regulations, Iceland, some people say, basically the whole country of Iceland was turned into a hedge fund. They borrowed enormous amounts of money short term from banks and others in England. They invested in very risky, very illiquid long-term investments that crashed. And so like a hedge fund, like long-term capital management, you might remember that from 2001 that was led by some Nobel laureates in economics. Iceland, like long-term capital management, crashed. Which crashed the whole economy. So there was a variety of experiences, partly but not entirely related to the degree of financial regulation that was in place.
Oh, all right. Well, okay. My question is: you showed on one of your graphs the rise in general indebtedness of the people here in the United States. Why did so many people go so much into debt?
Mary,
you mentioned a little bit about the role of markets internationally and how that played into some of the things that happened. So when we're talking about regulation, how do we get beyond that? Because if these investors and these executives can't do what they want to do here in the United States, they'll just take it overseas, and we still get the domino effect going on. Could you try and address that?
I'd like to ask about the banking system, because everything you say is valid, but it all is based on the assumption that we keep the system of private bankers. And I'd like to know if you believe that these people should not be able to take a pint of blood from us and say, we're going to, after you pay us, we got 2 pints of blood. Do you think we should not have a private banking system and have a totally governmental system? It should be a crime for anybody to say, I'm going to give you a pint of blood so that later you might give me 2 pints of blood.
I'll try to be brief because a lot of people have questions. Why so much indebtedness? I think there were several reasons. One was I tried to show you, because incomes have been stagnating so much, people have had to go into debt just to provide their some basic expenses, health insurance or health care, to buy housing, to pay for education for their kids. So just to survive, in a certain sense, a lot of people have had to go in debt. Number two, the credit card companies and others discovered that they could make tons of money by making it easy for people to take on more debt than they can really afford by charging enormous fees. Third of all, banks, especially during the subprime housing boom, really pushed debt on people. They got people to take on more debt than many people felt comfortable taking on by saying, oh, don't worry about it. You know, you take on this debt now. It's short term. Sure, the interest rate's going to go up by 7% in 3 or 4 years. But by that time, you can refinance it with other short term debt. And of course, when the system crashed, they couldn't do that. So, and then some people were just irresponsible, I mean, undoubtedly. But a lot of it, I think, was necessitous borrowing. Some of it was pushing by the banks, and some was this whole culture of consumption, I think, that has led people perhaps to take on more debt than they should have. Markets internationally. Yes, we live in a global financial system, and there is a very serious problem about how you can regulate the financial system in one place, even a country as big as the United States, without having global financial regulations. And part of the answer is for the citizens to have much more understanding and transparency of how global financial regulations are established. The fact of the matter is, a lot of these global financial regulations are established in these institutions that most of us have never heard of, and where none of us can have a seat at the table. Places like the Basel Committee of the Bank for International Settlements, or the international standard setters of the accounting board that make accounting standards so that if they do it the wrong way, they allow banks to make risky bets, put them off their balance sheets, and they don't have to hold any capital behind them. So there are a lot of these arcane international regulatory institutions where none of us have a seat at the table. So I think AFR and the groups that I'm involved in, we're also trying to make these international regulatory bodies more transparent by forming coalitions with others around the world to try to do that. But none of this is really the answer in the end. What we have to do, we can do this in the United States because we're a big, wealthy country. Not everybody can do this. But we need to go back to a situation that Keynes talked about, that FDR talked about, where we need to socialize and communitize and cooperatize enough of our finance, and this gets to the last point, enough of our investment, so that even if the money runs away, we won't care. Because after all, it's not the money. Money's just a piece of paper. It's the real resources. It's having the ability to mobilize our vast human and physical resources to invest, to create jobs, to buy things, to produce things. And even if the money runs away, that really won't make that much of a difference. You know, a related point is bankers have said, look, if you try to regulate our pay, you're going to have a banker brain drain, you know. First of all, I asked, well, what brains are you referring to? But
how much worse?
Exactly. So, you know, fine, good riddance. Go someplace else. We don't need bankers who are going to engage in this crazy speculative stuff. We need boring bankers. We need community bankers. We need social bankers who know how to get money to people who can really use it. So I think, yes, it is a global system. We do have to be careful about that. But in the end, we have to mobilize resources here at home, I think is the real answer. I had another question here. Will the concession of Posner's and others at the University of Chicago economics to Keynesian principles help to save the system? So some of you may know, what's his first name, Posner? What's Posner's first name?
Richard
Posner, who for many years was the father and leader of right-wing law and economics and very laissez-faire oriented, has now some kind of said I was wrong, sort of like Alan, he did an Alan Greenspan, right? Oops. So that's good. We need a lot of Richard Posners to do that, and they're not doing it. The economics profession is digging in its heels and saying, no, we just need to make small adjustments. My former professor, Alan Blinder, who was an associate chair at the Fed for a while and writes a very well-known textbook, said at a recent economics meetings, well, this economic crisis, maybe we have to change one of our chapters in our textbook, but otherwise we don't have to change much. So they're really incorrigible. So there aren't enough Richard Posners around.
Whoever thought I'd hear you say that, there aren't enough Richard Posners.
I mean, meaning people who reneged on the old stuff.
Born again.
Born again.
It seems to me that the top bankers, the heads of all the major banks that were bailed out, the big commonality that they had was no responsibility, no money on the line. My question would be how we could put a simple remedy. You want laissez-faire? Everybody raise your hand. Fine. Now, laissez-faire is just fine. All we're asking you to do is to make sure that all your money is on the line all the time that you're running the show. And another thing, there's no bailout.
Question?
That's it. Do you think something like that might be effective?
Accountability.
The question goes to the fact that there is an international banking set of oligarchies that control the majority of wealth on the planet. David Rockefeller is often cited as a spokesman for him, for them. And some time ago, he made a statement about auto-determination no longer serving their interests. Auto-determination being democracy. One world government under a financial elite and their technocrats is what they're moving for. There is literally too much production capacity on the planet. There isn't enough capacity. There isn't enough effective demand on the planet, given that wealth has been transferred from the poorest to the top and concentrated. So manufacturing doesn't keep profits up. What they seem to be doing is taking their resources and buying up public assets like water systems, education systems, parking meter systems. In essence, exploiting us, turning us into sort of serfs for them. Could you speak to that issue?
This is just a comment. That what we have now is a legalized form of corruption. And if it's legal, everything's fine. So if you look around, there's a lot of things that need to be done. But it's a legalized form of corruption. It's there right now. And the reason we can get away with it in this country is we're rich.
I'm not rich.
One more.
You're rich enough.
No, I'm not.
I was struck by at the end you mentioned HuffPost, and earlier you talked about 19 economists who were hiding their relationships to hedge funds. Are you familiar with the HuffPost work? Roughly, they first wrote it up roughly a half a year ago, and then they updated it. I just noticed today in October about how they studied the extent to which the Fed has been bankrolling economists, in particular economists who are on the editorial boards of major economics journals. Okay.
Damn, I missed that opportunity.
Yeah, and to piggyback on references made here, isn't that just a part and parcel of a systematic campaign of deceit where you had ratings agencies and Goldman Sachs and all of these folks? Is it really the case that this country for 200 something years has not had basic fraud laws which can be brought to bear on these outfits? Did they repeal every fraud law in the books in this country 20 years ago or so, or less?
Let me take the first point, which was maybe one of the reasons these bankers took so many risks is because they didn't have their own money on the line. Okay, they had somebody else's money on the line. And I think that's certainly true. It's not because of the fractional reserve banking system, because in fact, a lot of these firms that took all these enormous risks weren't banks. They weren't commercial banks. They didn't take deposits. Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, they weren't commercial banks. They didn't take deposits. No, it's because they could take enormous risks, so that by just say investing $5,000, they could make, you know, $1.5 million by writing these very complex derivatives. And if the bet went wrong, then their bank would lose, you know, $5,000. If they up this to $1 million, the hope of getting $10 million, the bank would lose $1 million. But before the bet went wrong, these bankers got their bonuses. They got their money back. And they did just fine.
Their wages and salaries.
Their wages, their salaries, their bonuses. They did just fine. Who ended up losing? It was the shareholders of the bank and the public that bailed them out. So yes, what you're saying is absolutely correct. How to solve that problem? Well, there's several ways. One is that the people who actually own these institutions ought to be able to have more say over what these institutions do. And I'm talking not only about wealthy individuals who invest in these institutions. I'm talking about pension funds, where many of us have our savings. Workers' pension funds own some of these banks, have a lot of stock in some of these banks, but yet have almost no control over what they're doing. So I think as a first marginal step, at least you ought to have a capitalism where it runs like capitalism, where the owners of the institutions have some say. But we also have to have strong regulations which say that these firms have to have their own money. These people have to have their own money at risk. Number two, they can't get the short-term profits from these kinds of bets unless we can show that they've made money in the long term. I actually think that there ought to be restrictions on the size of incomes that people in this can get relative to the average income in the economy. You know, we used to have a situation where the richest people made 20 or 30 times what the average person made, which is, you know, terrible in and of itself. Now it's up to 300 times, 500 times. Do I hear 1,000? I don't know. What? So I think we have to have a more progressive tax system that really taxes away these kinds of things. So I agree with you. A legalized form of corruption. Yeah, when you deregulate, as I said, you legalize corruption. But there's actually illegal corruption going on, too. There's a lot of people in the financial sector who do things that are actually illegal and ought to be in jail, and you're going to be seeing more of them getting put in jail. But yes, that's why you have to make this type of corruption illegal, by having strict rules. But is this all kind of whistling past the graveyard? Is the system so controlled by a small cabal of elites operating in the global system that everything that I've said tonight is pretty irrelevant, I think, as you're suggesting, and as you were suggesting, because what I'm talking about are some marginal changes, some somewhat more radical changes, maybe some broader changes. But ultimately, it's these, what, how many families do you say control the world? 100? 1,000?
Let's look at banks and who owns your bank.
Yeah, okay, so there's this argument out there that they control the world. But let's think about it. Let's say that's true. But what do they control?
Money.
Right. And as I said before, they control these financial assets, but these aren't real assets. Societies determine property rights. Property rights, the fact that I own this jacket, and if you try to come up and take it away from me, and I know this is a very beautiful jacket, so don't all rush it around. And that if you did, I could, you know, call the cops and say, you know, you can't do it. This is a social artifact. Societies write property rights. And property rights get rewritten over time by social movements, social revolutions, and so forth. So it really doesn't matter that much who on paper owns these social resources like money, if we as a society are willing to say we need to write the property rights differently, that there are things called the public commons, the clean air, clean water, enough of our common resources so that we can produce enough food for people to eat and so forth. We have to come together to start establishing social property rights so that we can fight against the 1,000 families, the 2,000 families, the 5,000, whoever 1,000 families there are out there. That's what a social revolution is about, and I think that's what we're all saying that in some way we need. So I'm not as pessimistic as you are, because I don't think this thing money has some, you know, religious supernatural force over our lives. We let it have that force over our lives because we allow ourselves to define property rights in such a way that it does. But if we start taking back the real resources that we have in our society, that we can really bring about some change.
I said I was going to come to this side.
There's two questions. How do we deal with a problem like where the congressmen and the senators are pressuring regulators not to regulate because they don't want certain things to happen? And how do you deal with a company like Goldman Sachs that writes these credit default swaps and these fancy derivatives and then sells them short and basically possibly even drags down Lehman Brothers because of cutting off their financing?
I know that the House Financial Reform Bill and I was wondering what's basically in it, and I assume it's not enough. If you could speak a little bit about that.
I'd just like to make a quick comment about three famous financial figures of the past and present who, when push came to shove, actually did see the light. The first was in the panic of 1907, was ended after President Teddy Roosevelt personally summoned J. Pierpont Morgan to the White House, said, look, you and your buddies are responsible for this thing in large part, and you can either clean it up or else. Morgan promptly went to Wall Street and ended the whole thing in a single day, and then a half dozen years later, he played a key role with his banker and industrial friends finding in the foundation of the Federal Reserve System, which brought reasonable stability, at least until the Depression.
Sure.
Then, when Joseph P. Kennedy was made the first chairman of the Security and Exchange Commission, the president emphasized his confidence in his ability to uncover dastardly financial schemes on Wall Street, since he told him he was the one who had invented a whole lot of them. And finally, to this day, Warren Buffett defines derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction.
But he bought a bunch of Goldman Sachs.
Thank you for that. By the way, there's one thing I forgot to mention is that there's this, in the 30s, there's this thing called the Pecora hearings, where they called up J.P. Morgan and all these guys who had crashed the system and called them on the carpet, and they had subpoena power, and they made them testify under oath about what they had done. This time around, and using that analogy, we have something called the Angelides Commission, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. In fact, it's had hearings today, and we'll have them again tomorrow, the second round of hearings. They don't have subpoena power, really. They're really treating these bankers with kid gloves. So another thing you can do, and maybe with the AFR on your own, is really show your outrage. That, you know, we have this crisis inquiry commission. They really ought to get at the bottom of what happened. I didn't answer your question. Yes, in our study, we saw that most of these economists also had positions with the Federal Reserve or the IMF and so forth. Though they were a little more likely to say that because I think they thought that gave them prestige. I think there should, at the minimum, and again, this is a small thing, but at a minimum, there should be a code of ethical conduct for all economists who are members of the American Economic Association, that when they, you know, make public pronouncements about public policy, they need to identify their associations. And that would have a small impact, not a huge impact, but I think it's a minimal kind of thing that we could promote. Congress and, oh, your point, you had 2 points. Yeah, this Congress has been very, very corrupt on this financial regulation issue as well as other issues. I don't know if you saw the article in Huffington Post, which verified something that I learned when I was on Capitol Hill talking to some of these people. The House Financial Services Commission, and somebody asked about the House bill, which I'll talk about in a minute. There was a strategy that the Democrats had to put a lot of first-year Democratic congressmen and women on the House Financial Services Committee. This is Barney Frank's committee. Which usually has, you know, 20 or 30 members and now is much larger than that. Why did they put so many freshmen, women, Democratic Congress people on that committee?
They didn't know anything and they wouldn't get reelected.
No. They put them on the committee. That would be not so bad. They put them on the committee so that they could get a lot of campaign contributions from the bankers. So that they could create a war chest and be reelected. This was a very obviously cynical strategy that Rahm Emanuel, maybe one of your congressmen, and Nancy Pelosi put together and has really made it difficult to get serious financial reform through that committee.
And in K Street.
Yeah. Obviously, to get to do any of these things, we need to get money out of politics, and that's an example. I think that's where your question was heading. What?
They also apparently pressured the standards-setting board for accounting to not do mark-to-market again, which would have made all these banks write down the losses and bye-bye for anyone who couldn't survive it.
Right, and that's right. And the government decided to give them "quote-unquote" forbearance. That is, let them pretend that they had high-priced assets when they didn't really. Yeah, exactly. Now, with the new Supreme Court case, it might seem like it would be very difficult to do something about this, and I think it does make it really difficult. But at the same time, Congress, as I understand, I'm not a lawyer, but maybe there are people who can correct me, but Congress really has the right to write its own rules. So they can say, you know, if you're going to sit on the House Banking Committee, you can't take money from bankers. And you can't, and it's worse than that, because the staff members of the House Banking Committee, I discovered, after they stop doing that, they go get jobs with the banks as well. So it's not just for the Congress people, it's also for the staffs of the Congress people. So it's a completely corrupt system. And the Congress could write the rules and say, you can't do this. We're going to police ourselves. So that's something we could urge them to do. Goldman Sachs, well, it's fraudulent. You know, when they're trying to sell these securities, at the same time, making bets against the securities and not telling their customers. I mean, that's what the Glass-Steagall Act, one of the things that it was designed to end. And this isn't, it may be a legal fraud or an illegal fraud, I don't know, but obviously that kind of thing needs to be regulated. Let me just quickly say about the House Reform Bill. I work with a group called SAFER, which is Economists Committee for Stable, Accountable, Fair, and Efficient Financial Reform. Don't think about that too much because it doesn't quite all work, but it's cute. And one of the things that we do is we go down to Capitol Hill and we talk with Congress people about financial reform. We often do this in conjunction with Americans for Financial Reform to help them out a bit. And we did do some work on the House bill. The House bill has some good things. It proposed this Consumer Financial Protection Agency, which some of you might know who Elizabeth Warren is. She's a Harvard Law professor, and this is her brainchild. She's the head of the Congressional Oversight Panel, a brilliant woman who really developed a really tough bill that would have strict regulation over banks, that would really protect consumers, that would push the Community Reinvestment Act very strongly. This bill got watered down in the House by various exemptions for various groups, but it was still survived to create this agency as an independent agency. So that's one good thing in the bill.
What's the bill number? He's asking.
I don't know.
Okay.
But you can find out.
You can go on Barney Frank's website, the House Financial Services panel, and it'll tell you. I'm sorry, I don't know. I can't remember what the number is. Some bad things is that it has very little in the way of stopping these derivatives products, these really dangerous, obscure derivatives products. There was some legislation proposed, and they just tore that away. I had a friend, his name's Rob Johnson, who works with AFR and also this place called the Roosevelt Institute. And he was, after a lot of pressure from community groups, including AFR, they said that he could come and testify in Congress about this derivatives legislation. Otherwise, they just had pro-derivatives, you know, bankers testifying. They called him up two nights before. They said, okay, you can do it. He had to prepare testimony. He stayed up all night doing it. Went there, and they only let him present it for about 5 minutes. And they cut him off. In the end, they have almost no controls over derivatives in that bill. One thing they do have, though, is some language that allows the regulators to break up banks that are too large. It doesn't require them to do it, but it allows them to do it. It also allows them to impose certain kind of Glass-Steagall kind of separation restrictions if the regulators choose to do that. So it's very weak, but it opens the door a little bit on some of these things. The Senate bill, on the other hand, is going nowhere at all, and so this regulation is likely to die, I think. We might get something, but it's going to be very watered down. That's because of the power of money in politics.
Well, people, we have reached the end of the event today, and we'd like to thank you.
Thank you very much.